It's indeed a pleasure to introduce our speaker, my friend, Dr. Rick Allaman. Dr. Allaman graduated from LSU in 1980. He was in small animal practice in New Orleans in 1980. He received his PhD degree in molecular biology of infectious disease at the University of Florida. Dr. Allaman is a diplomate in ABVP, American Board of Veterinary Practitioners. In the American College of Veterinary Pathology, specialty clinical pathology. He received the Florida Teacher of the Year Award in 1998 and 2002. He also received the Support Services Clinician of the Year Award and the Norden Distinguished Teacher of the Year Award. He is an Associate Professor and Resident Coordinator of Clinical Pathology at the University of Florida. The notes, by the way, are on page 83. Let's welcome Dr. Rick Allaman.
Thank you, Dr.
Welcome.
Very kind.
You're being very formal with me, you know, of course.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Dr. Childress. Very kind of you. If maybe we could just dim Ted. Oh, Dr. Childress, maybe you can dim the lights just a little bit. It is after lunch. Some of you might decide it's time to take a little nap. What we're going to do in this hour, and if you'd like to stay on and continue in the next hour, is we're going to pretty much cover the infectious diseases in the dog that are tick transmitted that I am familiar with, either through work in a clinic or work in our research laboratory. I'm not going to be talking about a lot of the research work that we have done with these diseases, unless it pertains to something that you might be interested in your clinical practice. So don't worry, this is definitely not a research talk. There are many questions that I can't answer about these diseases. There's new information emerging all the time. So what I'm going to try to do here today is present to you what we know about these organisms and how they relate to the host and the clinical diseases that they cause. And sometimes I'll throw in my opinion every now and then. But hopefully that'll at least arm you with information that you need when you're in your clinic, in the exam room, and have to talk about these diseases with the client. So that's the goal here. So this first session is going to focus on the Ehrlichias and the anaplasmas that occur in the canine. This is going to kind of be a low-tech presentation that I'll have to come over and push the button, okay? So if you talk about these diseases, and you go on the Emerging Pathogens website for the CDC, they'll talk about these organisms as emerging diseases in human and veterinary medicine. And I think there are a number of reasons why we have this problem of recognizing these diseases more and more in our clinical practices. One of them, and this actually is can be partly attributed to IDEXX Laboratories, who happens to be sponsoring this, is that we have better diagnostic capabilities. So maybe these diseases were around all the time. We didn't know it. But now we have assays in the clinician's hands where we can detect these infections much more readily. And so we're able to compile information in many areas of the country or in the world about these organisms and their true occurrence in the pet population. The other thing is that I really believe that we have a true emergence of these infectious diseases in many areas of the country. One is with housing developments that are spreading from the cities into the suburbs. In many places where you guys live, these suburbs are being developed that used to be rural areas, and we're now going into the habitat where not only the tick vectors are, but the wildlife reservoir that carries these diseases. So now our pets and people are being exposed to them. In addition to that, some of you may not know that we have a shipment of animals occurring worldwide. A lot of this has to do with the sport dog industries, like the racing greyhound industries. Many of these racing tracks, then when they have retired greyhounds, they don't really know what to do with them. So they have large kennels that keep these retired greyhounds. I know many veterinarians that are involved with helping these dogs and organizations that then take these animals from this country or other countries and ship them around. Now, certainly they're checking them for certain diseases, but they're not checking them for all of these tick-borne diseases, and that can spread them in different areas. Then we have people traveling with pets, sometimes traveling on vacation, sometimes seasonal traveling. We have a big problem in Florida with that because we have diseases in Florida that, when I first arrived in Florida in 1989, that we didn't recognize. But now we see Lyme disease and anaplasmosis in Florida, typically thought of as diseases that occurred in the Northeast. But you know how people travel back and forth between the Northeast area of our country and out to Florida for certain times. And we certainly have it. And if you look at the distribution of these diseases, it's often in the coastal areas where you know these people come and go. So these are a big problem, and those are just examples that may actually apply to some of the communities that you guys live in. Well, when you talk about the canine Ehrlichias and anaplasmas, there's actually five organisms that infect dogs. Of these five organisms, four of them have been documented to infect humans. Only one has not. And believe it or not, the one that has not actually been shown to infect humans is the last one, Anaplasma platus. It used to be Ehrlichia platus. Even Ehrlichia canis has been documented in humans, although not in this country, in Venezuela, but not here. So I don't want to scare you that you're all going to catch Ehrlichia canis, but it has been documented in people. The first little group that we'll talk about are the monocytic versions of the Ehrlichias. And we call them monocytic because they have a tropism to infect mononuclear cells in the animal, peripheral blood or bone marrow. And what we have here is a picture of a lymphocyte that contains a large morula of Ehrlichia canis bacteria, maybe 50 or 100 organisms within that cell. Now, it's extremely rare. In fact, I've never seen a case of ehrlichiosis where we were able to identify organisms within circulating lymphocytes or monocytes. So diagnostically, that's problematic. With the other forms of Ehrlichia and anaplasma, we can sometimes see organisms, but not the monocytic form. So as clinicians, then you have to be aware of the clinical signs that these animals might present with, some of the laboratory findings that you will see, and we'll cover those, and then know how to test for them and what your test means. There are two types of Ehrlichia that we call monocytic. One would be Ehrlichia canis. The other one is Ehrlichia chaffeensis. Now, this one was originally known as the human monocytic Ehrlichia when it was first recognized, but we know that it does infect dogs, okay? Ehrlichia canis transmitted by the brown dog tick. This tick is ubiquitous. It's been diagnosed and documented in all 50 states in the U.S. and around the world as well. It was originally brought into the United States during the Vietnam War, where we first recognized this disease in some of our military dogs, the German Shepherd dogs, that were getting very sick in Vietnam and developing what we classified at that time was tropical pancytopenia. And then these dogs would die from the disease, and then it was introduced into this country. So now, though, it is a worldwide infectious agent. This is a map that was actually supplied to me by IDEX Laboratories on some data that they have collected across the country, illustrating the different areas of the country where seropositivity to Ehrlichia canis has been documented. So you can pick out your state, and the darker the color, the worse you are with regard to Ehrlichia canis infection. As you'll see as I show you some of these maps, Florida is always one of the brightest spots in the country for infectious diseases, but there are many areas of the country where this disease is very common. And what you will find about these organisms that are tick transmitted is that when we talk about a state and prevalence, there are certain areas in that state where prevalence will be really high. So one practice that might have a location in an area where there's ticks and tick diseases will have a really high incidence of animals coming in with Ehrlichia infection, whereas another neighboring county might hardly ever see it. It's that focal in its orientation. Ehrlichia chaffeensis is kind of like the twin organism to Ehrlichia canis. It's transmitted by a different tick vector, but it has a very similar, what we believe to be very similar, clinical presentation. This is a map illustrating the human incidences of Ehrlichia chaffeensis infection. We don't have a good handle on the canine incidence of it, although we know that people who have done work with these organisms experimentally and testing different areas have found it frequently in animals. And this one happened to be done out in Oklahoma, just looking to see if the canine could be a reservoir for this organism in nature, because we knew the white-tailed deer was. And Dr. Alan Kosan actually did this work and found that in the 21 coyotes that he sampled, 15 of them were carrying this organism. And we, like I said, we have found it frequently in the canine population as well. It's kind of interesting with this bug is that it got its name, Chaffeeensis, because it was first recognized in Arkansas. And you can see this really hot spot here for human infection. And it was first diagnosed in a soldier on a military base in Fort Chaffee. And so that's how it became named and recognized as a human form of Ehrlichia. We believe that the clinical signs of these two infections are really indistinguishable in the dog. For Ehrlichia canis, disease is well characterized, both in natural infections and experimentally. So we'll go through that and just assume that dogs infected with Ehrlichia chaffeeensis are going to present with identical clinical and laboratory findings. So with these diseases, and with all diseases that we'll be talking about, there are three phases to infection. There's an acute phase, where the animal might show mild clinical signs. Then they go into a subclinical phase where they won't show any clinical signs. And then some animals will develop chronic phase of the disease. And this is pretty much typical of many, many tick-transmitted organisms, not even just the ones that we're going to be talking about today. So this acute phase naturally would occur 2 to 3 weeks after a tick bite, so the animal gets infected. The clinical signs, as I mentioned, are typically mild during this phase of the disease. This could vary if the animal is inoculated with a heavy burden of organisms or if it's a particularly virulent strain. And different areas of our country have very virulent strains of E. canis, and especially in South America and Mexico, some very virulent organisms. But usually, these animals don't present to you in the hospital. They typically would not. If you happen to get an animal in acute phase of the disease, the most common laboratory finding that you will see is a thrombocytopenia. And when we have animals that come in sick and we do a CBC on them and we recognize that they have a thrombocytopenia, that alerts us to one of the things that we need to investigate with this animal would be a tick-transmitted organism, because it's probably the most common hematologic finding that we find across the board with these infectious agents. During the acute phase, the titers might be negative. So if you happen to see an animal in acute phase of the disease and you test them either with an IFA or with a SNAP test, you might find that they're negative. If you still have a suspicion for the infection, you would treat, of course, and then retest 2 to 3 weeks later, and then you would find a positive titer if, in fact, they were infected. After this acute phase, and again, most animals won't present to you in the acute phase of the disease, they go through a subclinical phase where they have few, if any, clinical signs. Some animals, and I really don't know the exact percentage of population because we don't have a good handle on that, but some animals will have hematologic abnormalities even during the subclinical phase. And in fact, if they really do have hematologic abnormalities, they technically wouldn't be subclinical at that point, the most common being a thrombocytopenia. But it's typically mild, and you would not see these animals having any types of bleeding associated with the thrombocytopenia. During this phase, though, these animals do have a hyperglobulinemia and they have high titers. So these are the patients that are going to present to you, and if you're doing routine checking in your patients as they come through your hospital, they would be the ones that would be clinically healthy and then test positive on a SNAP test. Now, this subclinical phase can last a long, long time. With many of these diseases, we believe that they can last the life of the animal. Sometimes they don't cause clinical disease, and then sometimes they do, and the animal then develops a chronic form of the infection. Now, what actually causes this chronic phase to develop is not really well understood. I mean, we can make assumptions about that, and it's basically the same for all. We suspect that certain breeds, and in this particular case, it would be the German Shepherd, might be predisposed to developing the chronic form of the disease. Other stress conditions might play a role. other concurrent illnesses, particularly other tick-transmitted diseases. And that's a common problem because we know that ticks that transmit these organisms don't just carry one bug. They often can carry two or three pathogens that can be inoculated into the animal. So it's a common problem that we have to deal with these patients, and that might, again, cause the other organisms that they have to then have an imbalance in their immune system and allow them to proliferate and cause disease. The disease, if it occurs, can again vary. It can be very mild, or I've seen animals very severe disease that actually die from infection. The age at which they're inoculated initially might play a role in that. Again, certain breeds might. And importantly, I think, the strain of the organism. So if you're in an area of the country where you have a pretty virulent strain of Ehrlichia canis, you may see many animals that will develop chronic phase of the disease that can be quite significant and difficult to deal with. With these agents, we have to recognize that they're systemic infections. And because of that, the clinical presentation of patients with tick-borne diseases can be quite variable. And so we're listing some of the things that can happen with these animals, like lymphadenopathy, hepatomegaly, splenomegaly. They can have retinal disease. They can have polyarthritis, CNS disease. All of these things can certainly happen. But what happens in an individual patient can vary. So you never really can be sure that this particular clinical sign is not associated with the tick-borne disease. So one of the things that we really like to look closely at in animals with clinical disease is the laboratory findings. That usually is our key, because we know that the clinical signs can be quite varied. So when we see a patient that comes in ill and is thrombocytopenic, which is present in over 80% of animals with chronic ehrlichiosis, then we find out, okay, maybe we have a tick-transmitted disease. What kind of clinical presentation does this patient have? Could this be consistent with these types of disease that processes going on? The other thing that we see frequently in the chronic phase of the disease is a non-regenerative anemia, and that's associated with the anemia of chronic inflammatory disease. Some animals, and not all, but I just want to mention this here because we've had some referred in to our hospital in this condition, can have a marked lymphocytosis like this patient right here. And they get referred in because naturally when you have an animal that's got an 18,000 lymphocyte count and they look like this in the peripheral blood, you would suspect this could be a lymphoid leukemia that we're dealing with. And so we've seen them present like that. They usually have really high titers. The lymphocytes that are present in the animal's peripheral blood are kind of characteristic for chronic ehrlichiosis, and that's why I blew them up here. If you take a real close look at them, over 90% of the lymphocytes in the blood will be these small granular lymphocytes. They have little tiny granules in the cytoplasm like this animal did. And definitely when you see that, you need to check this patient for ehrlichiosis. This animal tested SNAP positive, the one I'm showing you here, and actually had a titer of 1 to 30,000. So had a really high titer and did not have a leukemia, but just had chronic ehrlichiosis. So how do we confirm a diagnosis once we have a suspicion that the patient actually could have a tick-borne disease? Well, you certainly would want to question the owner about exposure to ticks, and you may or may not get a positive result there because sometimes these animals could have been infected months, maybe years ago. You just don't know when they actually contracted the infection. The ways that we confirm it would be serology or PCR analysis. Now, serology really is the best way for us to confirm an infection. Now, I'll talk to you a little bit more about PCR analysis. One, it takes a while to get results back, and it's not very good in detecting infection with Ehrlichia canis or Ehrlichia chaffeensis. And the problem that we deal with these two organisms, Ehrlichia canis and Ehrlichia chaffeensis, is that our serological assays that we use can't distinguish between these two infectious agents. So the animal that comes in that you might see with Ehrlichia chaffeensis, you would be testing for Ehrlichia canis, and they would be positive. So we don't know exactly how many animals that we think are infected with Ehrlichia canis truly have Ehrlichia chaffeensis infection. We don't have a handle on that at this point. We know that it does happen, but PCR is the only way that we can distinguish between these two agents. And we just don't do that very often. So serology really is the key to diagnosing. We have two methods available for us. And we do both of these at our laboratory, but certainly more commonly you guys would have available to you in your lab, in the clinic, the SNAP test. The IFA test is kind of considered in many areas of infectious disease as the gold standard assay, primarily because this test is usually the first one that's developed whenever we have an agent that we want to develop a diagnostic test for. If you can culture the organism, you can very easily then make an immunofluorescent antibody test. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And that's why it's recognized as the gold standard. So whenever assays are developed after that, then they're kind of compared with the IFA test in their ability to detect disease and distinguish between infected and non-infected animals. In reality, it's not really a gold standard assay. And the biggest problem that we have with IFAs is false positive results. So it's not a good test if you're screening populations of animals to detect disease. It's definitely not in that case. And if the way that we utilize these assays is we actually, if we suspect the disease, we'll snap test them first. If we find a positive titer, then we do an IFA test to actually get a quantitative analysis of the antibody level in that patient. So this is a picture of an IFA for Ehrlichia canis. And I just want to describe a little bit about how this works. And maybe if you have some questions about IFA, it might kind of clear up some of the controversy associated with it. What we do is we take organisms, we grow them in cell culture, and then we adhere them to microscope slides. So you have the cell culture and the organism on a slide. And then we react the patient's serum with it at a certain dilution. So any antibodies that are specific for Ehrlichia canis would then stick to the organisms. We wash off any unbound antibodies, and then we use a secondary antibody that's labeled with this fluorescein tag so that we can see it microscopically. The problem is that if you use serum from a patient, of course there are lots of different antibodies in there, and if they're infected with Ehrlichia canis, they may react with the Ehrlichia organism. And they will be specific for Ehrlichia. But they may also have antibodies in there that might be present on Ehrlichia that are not just specific for that organism and actually might be present in a number of organisms and might bind to the Ehrlichia canis organisms that you have on your IFA. Then we can get nonspecific binding to the cells themselves that they grow in. So you have to really be a skilled microscopist to be able to identify what's background staining and what's true binding to organism that's a real positive reaction. Because of that, we really only consider an animal positive for Ehrlichia with an IFA if they have a titer of 1 to 64 or greater. Okay, so if you're using IFA assay, you would want to have clinical signs or laboratory findings consistent with Ehrlichia and a positive titer of 1 to 64 or greater. Just to kind of bring home what I'm talking about with regard to inability to really be accurate with these IFAs in all cases. Now, I'm not talking about the animal that has an IFA titer of 1 to 10,000. I'm talking about these low-titered animals. Those are the ones that are really questionable. What Dr. Craig Green did, and this is some time ago, was took a bank of serum samples and divided them into 10 aliquots and sent them to 10 different laboratories for IFA testing. And he got a 52% agreement in the samples that he submitted to these labs. So that's not very high. But it's really understandable just because of the way that these assays are done. And it really takes somebody who's used to running these assays and been doing them for a while to actually get good and accurate results. So if you're trusting your lab, that is real important. Okay, so what about the SNAP test, since most of us actually have access to this and are using it? These assays that are utilized on the SNAP test are not using whole organisms. It's kind of like a second-generation diagnostic assays. What they use is specific antigens that have been identified on Ehrlichia canis infection that actually cause an antibody response during the infectious process. So they take these antigens and then they synthesize them. So they're synthetically made and put on these test pads. Well, that does two things. One, that limits the amount of exposure that the patient's antibody has. They're not exposed to 100 different antigens. They're exposed to 2 here. In addition to that, instead of just taking microscope slides and putting cultured organisms on them, we really don't know how many organisms we have. There's not a good control on the antigen that's on the slide. These are calculated amounts of antigen that are put on there and designed to react at titers of 1 to 100 or greater. Okay? So a postdoc in our lab actually did this initial work on 3DX. This is when the assay first came out. And we found in our samples that we used, and these were experimentally infected animals as well as naturally infected animals that had titers to Ehrlichia canis, there was 100% specificity, meaning that we also had a bank of negative serum samples, and none of the negatives tested positives, and all of the positive animals that had Ehrlichia tested positive here. There were some animals that had Ehrlichiosis in our study, and at this time, this assay was actually designed to react at 1 to 300 or greater. Now it's down to 1 to 100, so sensitivity is better. But there were animals that had low IFA titers and experimentally infected animals during acute phase of the disease that we did not detect on this original assay here. But it's got a really high positive and negative predictive value if you're testing healthy animals, because that would be a low prevalence population. So you have a population of healthy animals you're testing. Naturally, the percentage of those animals that are going to have Ehrlichia infection are going to be much smaller than if you're testing animals with clinical and laboratory findings that are consistent with Ehrlichiosis. Okay, you would have a higher prevalence in there. So if you're using this as a screening test, it has a really high positive and negative predictive value for antibodies to Ehrlichia canis infection. But as you can see, these antigens are also present on Ehrlichia chaffeensis. So the animals that we know had Ehrlichia chaffeensis infection that we had samples on and did not have Ehrlichia canis, and this again was by PCR analysis, also tested positive with this assay. That's good for clinicians, kind of not so good for people who are trying to get a handle on what about this other pathogen that dogs can carry. Okay, so what about PCR? The big take-home message with PCR analysis with regard to these two diseases is that it's not very sensitive in detecting organisms if you use peripheral blood, because the organisms don't circulate. They very rarely circulate, so it's hard to find them. If you really want to use PCR analysis to, say, confirm a positive reaction on a SNAP test or an IFA, you have to collect it from the spleen or bone marrow. And that's how we do it experimentally to confirm infection in these animals, because the peripheral blood is just not that sensitive for it. So that's the bottom line with PCR analysis in these particular infectious agents. So what about treatment? Currently, this is what the recommended treatment for Ehrlichia infection is: 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram of doxycycline twice a day for 30 days. And we believe that this will eliminate most infections. And definitely it seems to clear clinical signs in animals that are only infected with Ehrlichia canis or Ehrlichia chaffeensis. Prognosis is usually good in most cases, but in this particular case it was not. And when you see animals that have a bone marrow that has been wiped out by this organism, which can happen in chronic ehrlichiosis, it's very difficult to get these animals to recover. This particular animal had pancytopenia associated with it, and it was actually owned by one of our interns who was a Ross veterinary student, and the dog was over there in the Caribbean Islands with her and contracted ehrlichiosis there. And evidently the trip over here must have had a stressful event for the dog, and then it broke with chronic ehrlichiosis, developed a very severe disease, and became pancytopenic and then died. This animal had the highest titer I've ever seen. And our laboratory titered it out. Tony, who's been doing these IFAs for years, titered it out to 1 to 3 million, and then she stopped. She said she didn't want to go any further. So they can have really high titers. We've seen many, many dogs that have titers into the tens of thousands. I've often been asked about what else can you use to treat ehrlichiosis besides doxycycline. Doxycycline definitely is the drug of choice, and that would be certainly the first line of therapy in any animal. People have talked about using imidacarb to treat ehrlichiosis, and there's been empirical information to say that, you know, it really works well with these animals. They come in and they're severely ill. You can give them a shot of imidacarb. They seem to respond more rapidly than doxycycline. Some people use it in combination with doxycycline, although really no studies have looked at those two together. And for a while, we really didn't have any studies looking at imidacarb, but now we do, and I'll describe what they actually found with that. The one that's been tested also to be effective in vitro, anyway, is rifampin. And that, this drug, this is antimicrobial, has been kind of touted for a number of tick-borne diseases when doxycycline isn't effective. But I would hate to give you a dose because, it's only been tested in vitro. And so I don't know the efficacy of this drug to use actually in animals. Certainly doxy is the one that we go with. The bottom line on imidacarb therapy is that it doesn't seem to kill the organism. Empirical information, even in the literature, said at first it looked like it worked well. This came out of South Africa, where they have a lot of tick-transmitted diseases, but maybe these dogs were just infected with other things as well as Ehrlichia that imidacarb seemed to help. But here in the U.S., this group from Louisiana State actually published this study in Internal Medicine Journal last year, where they actually finally infected animals with Ehrlichia canis and then treated them with two doses of imidacarb and found that none of them cleared of the infection using imidacarb. And it's really not surprising, because if you look at the work that was done before by this same group, they found that it didn't work in vitro. It did not kill the organism, where doxycycline was effective in vitro in their study. So I honestly believe that it does not kill the organism. Whether it does anything for clinical presentation or, you know, helping with the clinical signs of the disease, I guess I'm not really sure of. But it definitely doesn't clear the infection in these cases. One of the problems and one of the reasons that we've altered the dose of imidacarb is that we've known for, not imidacarb, I'm sorry, doxycycline, is that we've known for a long time that this drug doesn't clear animals of infection. And this was at the old dose that was being used. And you can see in one study, 50%, in another study, 44%, were still positive after being treated with doxycycline. So then we increased the dose, and as best that we can tell, and that's the current thoughts, is that 4 weeks of doxy at the higher dose seems to clear infection. The problem is, how do you know? You know, because titers can persist a long, long time, even once you clear infection. With most of these diseases, it appears that if you do clear infection, the antibody titers will drop and eventually go away. How long will that take? It could take a long time, a year, 2 years, for these animals to clear. And you can't really tell much by just doing SNAP tests on these patients. They can still be positive after you've treated them, and it really won't mean anything. The best that we can assume at this point is to retest them 6 months after you've treated them by IFA, and that would require you getting an IFA assay done prior to treatment, see what the antibody levels are, treat them, test them 6 months later, and look for a fourfold drop in antibody titer. And that would at least be some indication that your therapy had an effect. And I don't want to say it's a guarantee that the organisms are gone, but certainly it's the best that we can do at this point, except for maybe doing PCR analysis from a splenic aspirate or a bone marrow aspirate. Okay? Most of these animals, again, will respond very well. In certain areas of the world, in this country, we have a high mortality, but again, that really varies with where you practice and what kind of a virulent strain that you're seeing. I think that it's one of the things that we're coming to recognize about these co-infections. And because for years we've had these animals, maybe some of you have come across them, that you've diagnosed with Ehrlichia canis infection, you put them on doxycycline, they seem to be doing well, but when you take them off of doxycycline, they seem to get sick. And so you want to keep them on doxycycline or give them pulse doses of doxycycline to keep this under control. Well, what we're recognizing is that many of these animals, and I think it's worthwhile testing them, have Bartonella infections, and we'll talk about Bartonella next hour. And Bartonella does not respond to doxy. Many of our tick-transmitted diseases will respond well to doxycycline, but not Bartonella. And we know it infects dogs, and it causes really different kind of chronic and persistent infections that can be difficult to handle. So if you have one of these animals, it's worthwhile testing it either serologically, primarily serologically, for Bartonella species infection. And again, we'll talk a little more about that later. It's a big problem with co-infections. So what do we do with these infected carriers? Or what do we do with these animals that test positive on an annual evaluation and they're not sick? And I'm sure you all have protocols to deal with these. I'll just kind of give you my opinion on how to work with these animals, and then kind of course, leave it up to you and your clients on what you want to do with them. I think that definitely when you're looking at false positives and false negative results, the way to test these animals certainly is with a SNAP test, because we get very, very, very few false positives. So an animal that tests positive on SNAP has antibodies, in my mind, to Ehrlichia canis. Are they still infected? What we know about the organism is that it causes chronic persistent infections and doesn't like to go away. So if they're positive, it is more likely that they're carrying the organism than not. So we're not dealing with an infectious agent that infects an animal, and once they recover, it's gone. That doesn't happen very often, as best we can tell, with Ehrlichia canis and many of these tick-transmitted diseases. They establish this host-organism relationship that works very well until something gets disturbed and then they get sick. So I think the best thing that we can do is do a CBC on these patients to see, is this animal having any hematologic effects from this infection that maybe the client's not perceiving clinically at all? And if there is a thrombocytopenia or a non-regenerative anemia, I think they should be treated. And then, you know, you could go from there, depending on how far you want to carry it and how concerned the owner is with regard to what else can we do to detect any evidence of an active ongoing infection in these patients. If you treat them, you need to treat them for the recommended period of time, and I think it's best to do an IFA titer on these animals to see what your treatment is going to do. If some of you have been treating these animals that are positive, you might notice some of the clients, now maybe this is the stimulus effect of the doxycycline, I don't know, but I've had this happen where the clients will say they seem to be more active and their appetite's better now that you've put them on this drug. And now whether that's killing the organism or whether that's just the effects of doxycycline, maybe it causes euphoria, I don't know. But something happens with some of these animals that you put on doxycycline. If you don't elect to treat them, I think that it's good to be aware this animal might be a carrier. Not from a zoonotic potential, but from potential that what might happen to this patient sometime in the future, whether it's elective surgery, or maybe the patient develops an immune-mediated disease, a neoplastic disease, has to be immunosuppressed, or it all of a sudden gets sick and it breaks with something else. So it's good to know, although I personally think they should be treated. Okay, so we're moving on into the anaplasma area, and we're kind of grouping these anaplasma and Ehrlichia because I have two organisms here that cause identical clinical findings, but are different in that they come from different genuses. If you look at the organism in the peripheral blood, like we're seeing this animal here infected with Anaplasma phagocytophilum, you can't tell them apart. And you can find these organisms because usually, as best we can tell, you see these animals in the acute phase of infection. That's when you see them. They get infected, they get acutely ill, and then they present to you, unlike Ehrlichia canis. So what we have here is the granulocytic forms of the disease where you have a morula with several bacteria in this little pod infecting the circulating neutrophil in this particular patient with Anaplasma phagocytophilum. The same thing will be seen with Ehrlichia Ewingi. Now this organism, Anaplasma phagocytophilum, used to be three different organisms, Ehrlichia equi, Ehrlichia phagocytophilum, and the human granulocytic agent, at one time thought to be three different organisms. But then some work was done looking at the genetics in these organisms, and they were found to be only a single organism and renamed Anaplasma because they are more closely related to the other species in that genus, namely Anaplasma marginale, the cow infectious agent, tick-transmitted disease. And maybe some of you don't practice bovine medicine, but just interestingly, we have known for years that Anaplasma marginale causes chronic persistent infection and that it doesn't respond well to tetracyclines either. So again, the same theme occurs over and over with these agents. Depending on where you live and practice, you may or may not see Ehrlichia ewingi. It's kind of in the central and eastern parts of the United States. It does infect humans as well. There have been human infections reported from Missouri, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. And its reservoir is the white-tailed deer that's at least suspected, similar to what Ehrlichia chaffeensis has. We make this diagnosis primarily by finding the bug, Ehrlichia ewingi. We don't have a diagnostic assay that tests for this. These animals present with polyarthritis. That's the primary clinical complaint, is that they're lame, they don't want to rise, stiff, stilted gait, swollen joints. That's how they present typically. And this is joint fluid from a dog that we had come to clinic that was PCR positive for Ehrlichia ewingi. And so here we have a joint fluid with several neutrophils in it because it was inflamed. And in one of these neutrophils, we found the morula. Not just one, they were in several of the neutrophils. And again, we find these bugs in these animals that are clinically infected. You have to look for them. We don't have serology for this organism because we can't grow it. No one's been able to culture it. We tried again with this particular case that actually was a person who's from Florida, but she went, her and her family took the dog, went to Arkansas on a camping trip, and then came back and the dog was sick. So we do have PCR analysis for this bug. Here's another one that is creating a little bit of, discussion in the tick-transmitted disease world, and that's Anaplasma phagocytophilum. We can grow this organism, so we have diagnostic assays available for it. And this is just a picture of some of our culture cells, which happens to be a human leukemia cell line, and you can see these organisms growing inside the cell line. This organism is a gram-negative bacteria, and it is transmitted by Ixodes ticks and in the East Scapularis and the West Pacificus, and not only the East, but also in the central U.S. as well. So it's transmitted by the same tick that transmits Lyme disease. So we have a lot of areas that deal with Lyme disease also deal with this infection, and again, it causes, as a primary clinical sign, polyarthritis. So it's often kind of mistaken for Lyme infection when you see it clinically. It will infect a wide variety of animal hosts. And this is only a partial list. The animals that will cause clinical disease in are humans, dogs, cats, horses, and ruminants. The rest of these are carriers. And there's lots of them. I mean, there's been lots of wildlife where this organism has been found. So it can infect, I think, just about anything with fur and that will pick up a tick can catch this little bug. We don't, as of yet, but we're going to get there, have a good geographic distribution of canine anaplasmosis. This is a human map. Not a human map. It's a map of human infections with human monocytic Ehrlichia, which would be in the brown, and human granulocytic Ehrlichia, which is Anaplasma phagocytophilum in the blue, and the purple would be where there's both. So, you know, we're doing really well with collecting these bugs. It's a real problem up in the northeast and the Midwest, upper Midwestern areas of the country, in Wisconsin and Minnesota. In fact, it was first recognized in Wisconsin. In people. So microscopic identification, again, is how we identify this organism, either in joint fluid or in the peripheral blood. This is the case I showed you in the peripheral blood. This is actually a picture of ewingi. But we see organisms in the neutrophils in joint fluid from animals with phagocytophilum as well. We do have serology available. There are IFA tests that are available for Anaplasma phagocytophilum, so you can do IFA tests. And we have PCR analysis that's available. And now the new SNAP4DX, the fourth assay on that test, is for Anaplasma. Okay, and it's very similar in that it uses antigens that are synthetically produced as a diagnostic assay. A different antigen, of course, than the ones that are used with the Ehrlichia canis. So what about clinical signs? They can, again, be varied, although polyarthritis is the primary clinical complaint. But these animals can sometimes present just with vague, nonspecific illnesses, achy, malaise, reluctant to move. Sometimes they have respiratory disease, the cough. Occasionally it'll cause meningitis, so they can come in with neck pain or even evidence of seizure activity. But again, it's almost identical when it comes with polyarthritis to Lyme disease. And it was first recognized in the canine population because, again, these areas had Lyme disease. And what we found is that animals that looked like they had Lyme tested negative. And so, well, what the heck is going on with all these animals that look like they have Lyme disease in areas where we know it occurs, but they're negative for Lyme? And then, naturally, we found out that they're infected with anaplasma. These animals will go through very similar findings as the monocytic form of the disease in that they become thrombocytopenic, but they also can have a hypoalbuminemia as well. And this hypoalbuminemia usually disappears. It's very mild, and they don't actually form edema or ascites with it, and it usually disappears once the fever goes away in these patients. We'll talk a little bit about lymphadenopathy later. Treatment with Ewing eye is the same. I want to kind of wrap this up a little bit here, so I'm going to advance a little forward because I don't want to go into the break time. Treatment is the same, 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram of doxy for 30 days. Suspected low mortality with this disease unless there are co-infections, and you know, all bets are off at that point. I want to tell you a little bit about what we have found with this organism. We did a couple of experimental trials with dogs where we infected them first time with a human isolate that we treated after they were infected. I'm going to make this story short, with 2 weeks worth of doxycycline. And after we treated them, these animals were still PCR positive. We thought that they were not sick. And this was a human strain that we had grown in culture. We didn't get them to become PCR positive until we immunosuppressed them. And we were required to do that because we were trying to adopt them out. We thought the infection was a failure, that we didn't infect these animals because they weren't sick, but they were PCR positive. So then we ran a second trial where we inoculated them, not with a cultured isolate, but with a wild type that was actually isolated from a dog in Minnesota, with the same results. You know, the animals, this time they did get a little ill. They had cyclic fevers over the first couple of months. Not very severe, though. Then it went away. They were PCR negative until we immunosuppressed them. Now, they will stay positive on serology during this time, but they were PCR negative, and we couldn't find them during these chronic infection until they were immunosuppressed. We treated them with doxycycline for 30 days at the required dose of 10 milligrams per kilogram, and they were still positive after that treatment. Now, I don't know what that means, because these animals were immunosuppressed before and after treatment. So I don't know. We'll just kind of wrap up here with whether or not doxy. Certainly doxy seems to be effective in clearing clinical signs, no question about that. Let me tell you a little bit about when we presented this data at the Rickettsial meeting last spring, the MDs were really disturbed and felt like it was not accurate. We had only done one trial, not two, and they felt that this was wrong, that chronic infections do not occur. It's only acute disease, that's all. But if you look in the literature, they have some information in their own literature that says that 15% of these residents of Wisconsin were positive for this disease, although they weren't never treated for it. So they thought at that point that maybe it was a common subclinical or mild infection that just went away on its own. Now, these were not PCR positive. This is seropositive. Then they surveyed people who had anaplasma and were treated for it and found that some of these individuals felt like, even though they were treated, that their health status wasn't as good as before they were infected. So I think that at least there's some evidence that these may be persistent infection in people as well. So I don't know about what we're going to find in these dogs. The bottom line is it definitely causes acute disease. We don't know that it causes chronic disease. It causes, in my mind, chronic infection. Whether or not these animals would then come down with disease or not is a question I don't think is clearly understood. But certainly co-infections can play a role in that, especially in co-infection with Lyme disease or Bartonella. So I think we'll end there. And if you have any questions, yes, sir. Great question. What would I recommend for an animal that is anaplasma positive but is not clinical? At this point, because I can't demonstrate chronic infection in these patients, I would not treat them. I don't know. Because we don't know that they cause chronic disease. But, you know, at this point, I'm going to clarify that because I don't know what we're going to find out in the future. What area are you living in, sir? In Connecticut, yeah. Yeah, so you got a lot of positive. Have you been treating them? You have. And what about, have you had any animals come in that were clinical that you had known were positive for a while before? Can you remember? Or just the clinical ones are all acute? Yeah, yeah. I just wonder whether it causes chronic disease. I know it causes chronic infection, and I don't know that we can clear the infection with doxy. So I don't know what to do with those animals, you know? I just really don't know. I know that's not a good answer.
So in regards to gray hens and the high number that are mm-hmm. at what point in the CDC, considering they tend to be mildly thrombocytopenic,
what? Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. What about the greyhounds that might be Ehrlichia positive? You have to use greyhound normals to check the thrombocytopenia. Absolutely, yeah. You don't want to be, because, you know, those animals, if you haven't worked with greyhounds, they live in a state of thrombocytopenia, so to speak, but that's normal for that breed, you know. So I think you got to get below 150, yeah, before you start thinking that they're thrombocytopenic. And you need to watch greyhounds, because they are they're aliens, actually. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Anaplasmosis positive on the 4DX. Is there really an advantage of using the 4DX over using the 3DX as a screening?
Okay, here's a question. If you're not going to treat these animals that are positive but are not clinical for anaplasma, is there really a reason to really be testing a clinically healthy animal? I think that until we know what happens with them, I would want to know if an animal is positive. I personally would. Because you don't know whether or not these patients will actually come down with disease. And when we talk about Lyme disease, I'll tell you a little story of a practitioner in Minnesota who actually followed his Lyme-positive patients for a year and what happened to them. And I think that's what we need to be doing right now, is testing these animals and following them and seeing which ones break or if they break with disease sometime down the road. Yes? Right. So the question is, you know, what about animals that get treated and might recur with disease, and you put them on doxy again, and they're not positive, they're not PCR, which PCR is an excellent assay for diagnosing this disease in clinical cases. And then you put them on PRED, and they seem to do well. Certainly, all of these diseases that are systemic have, not only do they have the organism, but they have soluble antigens that get in the bloodstream. And they like to stick to things, and they can definitely stick to sticky little platelets. And they can induce then a reaction against the animal's platelets. And that definitely can occur. In some animals with polyarthritis, even when you put them on doxy, the polyarthritis doesn't really go away completely. And you have to add PRED because of the immune component that occurs with them. So it absolutely can occur. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's a question that no one yet has a good handle on. The question is that she's seeing dogs co-infected with anaplasma and Lyme disease, and we're certainly seeing them. And some of these animals get really severe illness and don't respond. And we certainly believe that co-infection kind of has an additive effect on the disease process that's occurring. And co-infection, in my mind, definitely enhances the possibility of these animals having immune complex diseases that will develop in vascular spaces, in, you know, small capillaries and vascular, develop DIC, deposit in the kidneys, cause glomerulonephritis. And these animals are really hard to save. And I don't know what else to tell you to do with them. The co-infection problem is a big issue that we don't have a good handle on, because it's really difficult to then design trials with these co-infections and then follow these animals and to see what they do. You have to have a reason besides just wanting to know. Yes, ma'am. Right. Yeah, I think that that's worthwhile. Definitely, if you want to at least check a CBC, because again, thrombocytopenia is one of the common clinical findings. Yes? Right. Right. The question about reinfection is, are animals that are treated, are they susceptible to reinfection? And they are. And that is one of the things that we recognize with many of these diseases. Yes, you treat them, and you, if you can clear them, the antibody titer disappears, but they're susceptible to reinfection. They can be. Yes, sir?
For your PCR for anaplasmosis, can that be run on peripheral blood?
Yeah, the question is, can PCR be run on peripheral blood for anaplasma infection? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And again, it's good for, it's excellent for detecting infection in animals that are clinical. It's these subclinical animals that we know we miss on PCR, even in peripheral blood with this disease. Got an immunosuppressant, which I don't guess people are going to really let you do that. Okay, so maybe we should take a little break, and or should we get...
We have a break in this refreshments and exhibit hall, and we can reconvene at 3:35.
Oh, it's a long break.
Yep.
Okay, so we'll reconvene at 3:35, Dr. Childress? Okay, and the refreshments in the exhibit hall. So thank you all very much, and we'll finish up a little later. My little girl.